Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 29th, 1998, and in the fireside room today, we have Bruce Berner. He's going to be talking about OJ, Au Pair, Oh My. Now let's go listen to Bruce.
And then there's magic people in another room that that start something, and then this gets preserved. On the assumption that it's worth preserving, apparently. My name is Bruce Berner. I teach in the law school at Valparaiso University. And this week we're going to be looking at a variety of aspects of the American legal system. We're going to start today with the criminal justice process. We'll talk a little bit about OJ and the Au Pair and a few other individuals that have populated the our television sets for the last several years. But I want to try to bring all of them into a more general understanding of how the process works and what sorts of things are our intention in the criminal process itself. I will be 20 times more comfortable when you start asking questions. Law school, and we have one of our grads here with us today, and he'll tell you that law school is a lot of interchange, and classes really depend on the students having questions, and of course it also depends on their having read the material, and that's a burden that we don't put on you. Let's just talk a little bit about some of the generalities about the process. And again, feel free to interrupt me at any time. There are a lot of tensions that go into making the criminal process in this country what it is. And I'm not going to make an effort to identify them all, but I do want to identify three of them I think help us begin to understand the big picture of why the process looks the way it does. Many people, when they watch the news or when they have an opinion about the case, they always end up saying, why does the law do this? They must be crazy. Those lawyers, right? So part of my job here is to sort of provide a little bit of an apologia for the system and to give you some idea at least of why it may be that something has to work that way. By the way, I want to be real clear. Sometimes the legal system just gets it wrong, because it's made up of a lot of people whose motives aren't always pure, and sometimes they make a mess of it. But probably not so often as the average person guesses, just getting reports from what the news media gives us. One of my standing principles is that the media is not mainly interested in telling you everything. It's mainly interested in telling you certain themes that it plays, and it plays them because they sell newspapers and television shows, etc. So whenever you hear a story that sounds wrong, a man hit a little girl on purpose and hurt his hand and sued the little girl and got $10 million. And we hear these kinds of stories all the time. 8 out of 10 of them are just false. They didn't happen anything like the way they're reported, but one of the themes that the media has is that the legal system is spinning out of control. And so those kind of stories fit in. Some of them have a little grain of truth, but they're never anything like they're reported. Here are the tensions I want to talk about. The tension here, and these are funny little letters, there will not be a quiz, you don't have to remember what they are. But in a brilliant article in the 1950s, a scholar named Herbert Packer wrote about two ways of visualizing the criminal justice process. And one of them he called the crime control model. That is, how would you construct the process if the only thing you were interested in is driving crime down and controlling it? And he articulates throughout this article what that system would look like and would have a lot of features to it. A lot of the things that we have in ours wouldn't be in there. A lot of the things that we don't have would be in there. Then once he has done that, then he sets up another process which he calls the due process model, What would the system look like if we were mainly concerned, or maybe even exclusively concerned, with not convicting innocent people, with respecting everybody's rights under the Constitution? What a surprise. That process looks very different. And if you're looking for a metaphor for those two processes, the crime control model looks like what? It looks like a conveyor belt. It looks like mass production right down the line. The due process model, on the other hand, looks like an obstacle course. It looks like you'll never get to the end of it because there's so many rights to protect, so many things to be careful about. What we have, of course, is a combination conveyor belt and obstacle course. Sometimes it depends on exactly who's in it, right? Take a look, for example, at the way O.J.'s case gets tried, and compare that to the way a typical homicide case gets tried in, say, Mississippi. And you get obstacle course, conveyor belt, pretty quickly in your mind. When O.J.'s case was getting set to be tried, we took a survey of all the lawyers in the two-county area in Indiana where we are, and we asked them this question. Given what you know about the main outline of this case, how long would it take to try it? And the estimates ran anywhere from 2 days to 2 weeks. It's not a complicated case. The only thing complicated about the case is the DNA evidence. And that's not all that complicated either, unless you really endeavor to make it so. Okay. So, but of course, in the O.J. case, there are a lot of things that conspired to make that case last, what, 8 or 9 months?
9 months.
When we find 9 months? Yeah, when we finally got, that's the gestation period of an O.J. trial is 9 months, right? because all kind of other things got involved there that aren't involved in the typical case. The second tension, this tension is a little reminiscent. If you just sat through Fred Niedner's Bible study, you get some of the same feeling here, and that's the tension between what I call principle and politics. By politics, I don't mean senators and congressmen and presidents and that kind of thing. By politics, I mean understanding that you can't always get the best result. That politics is, if it's anything, the art of the possible. So we talk about principle as this is the way it should be in a perfect world if we have all of these ideal conditions, and we'll call politics the kind of compromises that we have to make if we want to get any result at all. One thing about the legal system that, and I know it's, people have all kind of opinions about the legal system, most of them negative. But one thing that I think people tend to forget is this. Most systems that are asked to decide things, think of the scientific system, we give scientists problems. Will this, if we do this, will it produce that? Those systems all are capable of giving us three answers, basically. There's subdivisions, but basically they can say yes, no, or we don't know. We can't tell. But you know, the American justice system isn't allowed to give that third answer. They can't bring the plaintiff and defendant in when it's over and they say, you've all spent thousands of dollars for lawyers and we've considered it, and you know, we don't know. Check somewhere else. Maybe you can get an answer somewhere else. The system obviously is forced to give an answer, and any system that you force to give a dyadic answer, an on-off, yes-no answer, is bound to get some wrong. And how it gets it wrong is a function of how you design it. The criminal system can make two mistakes, right? It can convict innocent people, or it can acquit guilty people. You start with which mistake is worse. And once you get a handle on which mistake is worse, and once you can explain why, then you begin to build the system so that if it is going to make errors, it'll more likely make one kind than the other kind. And the other tension in the system is the tension between how much of it will be run by specialists, that is, how much of the outcome will be a function of lawyers and judges and expert witnesses and other people who are in their particular field of specialty, and how much of it is to be decided by the community. Here it comes, the jury, right? And in fact, we're going to see when we go through the blue sheet here a series of places where the community is intentionally involved in the process. Why? A lot of historical reasons, right? Part of it is to give a sense of ownership to the community that they own the system, that it's not just a bunch of crazy people who have been educated in an odd way deciding these things, but that all of us have a stake in this. And also because the system, if it got too disjoined from the community that it served, simply couldn't work. So we build that community in at certain levels. And of course, one of the great questions that jury selection provides, and we certainly got plenty of debate about it in the OJ case, is which community? How do we understand the community? We all know that choosing to try that case downtown LA rather than in the Simi Valley makes it a very different kind of community in terms of how it gets itself represented on the jury, right? Major decision in the case to try it downtown. We know the history of that. We know the Rodney King cases and what happens when they try it the other way. So that was all a part of that. Let me just challenge all of you before we go through this. If you want to talk about OJ, that's great. But I want to challenge you this way. I want to find someone. I found one or two. I better tell the truth here. I found one or two. But I haven't found many people whose opinion on that case at the end, that is guilty or not guilty, was not the opinion that they went in with. For a lot of reasons. It's like C.S. Lewis's piece about miracles. Whether or not you believe in them is a function of whether or not you believe in them in the first place. Because you will interpret all evidence in accordance with the philosophical assumptions that you make in the first instance. And so when we get what looks like a miracle, people who don't believe in miracles will have a way of explaining that. And the people who do will have a way of saying, there it is, it's a miracle. Ah, it's not a miracle because of this, 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 and this, right? Let's take a start here. First of all, questions before we start. Just a few sort of statistics to prime your interest here on the blue sheet here. You see, the criminal process is a long process. It has a lot of different steps to it. You'll notice at the very bottom that the appearance on the Geraldo show is the very last thing that happens in the process. Sometimes that appearance comes a little earlier, but it's always at the end. It's a nasty process, and it's a nasty process from beginning to end. It's an awful struggle, as you would expect it would be. There are many lawyers who will not practice it. It's considered in many legal communities as part of the dirty side. Okay. I have a good friend whose practice is limited to criminal law, divorce, and bankruptcy. And he makes a great living because no one else in that community wants to practice those, because those are all the... push them over here. Let's do corporations and let's write wills for nice people. The criminal process really is a nasty process. Reported, detected, or observed crime, from the best we can tell, fewer than half of all the crimes that are committed ever reach the attention of the authorities. And I am not talking about traffic now. Okay, let's get traffic out of the way. Traffic is technically a crime. But you can't do any meaningful statistics about crime until you get rid of the numbers that are traffic, because as you can guess, if you get a set of numbers that that combine all other crime and traffic, what you have is traffic numbers, because they so predominate numerically that you can never tell anything about crime until you get rid of traffic. So for the rest of the day, we're not talking about traffic. Of all the crime then, non-traffic, probably the best we can tell is we're learning at any level about less than half of it. Of course, by definition, we can't be sure. Get it? But we have some indicators that tell us we're probably learning less than half of it. Yeah.
This is a little bit tardy on the questioning,
no,
but
good.
A real brief comparison between U.S. systems, or is the U.S. system very unique in criminal justice, or are we similar to a lot of other nations?
The main division worldwide on how criminal processes work go along the line of what would be called an inquisitorial system and an adversarial system. The inquisitorial system, which is continental Europe, which is most of Asia, is in some ways something that we might have guessed would have been more American. And that is, everybody gets together and we get a lot of experts and a lot of opinions and we just investigate it and figure out what happened.
So you have these investigative judges.
You have investigative judges. You have the investigators and the jury are the same people. So the same people who do the investigating and find out all the facts are the people who decide the case. In other words, it's like the way we decide most things, right? And the adversarial system, of course, which we get from Great Britain, okay, we have differences with Great Britain in terms of how we understand law, but the great thing that holds us together is the adoption of the adversarial system. And that adversarial system is, again, part of this tension here. If you want to think about it, you can think about the prosecutors and the police sort of representing crime control, and the defense counsel representing the idea of due process. We'd like the judge to sort of overarch and consider them both. And, you know, it's not as if half of the people in the world are crime control people and half of them are due process people. Sometimes it seems that way when you have a debate, right? It sounds like if you have a debate about the death penalty, the insanity defense, it looks like you can choose up sides, right, and have the crime control people and the due process people. But the truth is, almost all of us are both. You see, I want crime control, especially in my neighborhood. Right? On the same hand, I want people's rights to be respected. I am schizophrenic. Well, that's just a nasty word for talking about I have two things that are in tension. I understand their intention, and that's going to have to produce some system that takes account of both. But yeah, the main difference in our system is adversarial system. And again, you know, law students, they get to the second or third year, and they don't get how weird this is, because by then they think it came with the trees and the rocks. You know, there's the trees and the rocks and the adversarial system, right? But if you were deciding where to go on vacation, should we go to Alaska, or should we go to Holden Village for 2 weeks? How will we decide that? I know, here's how we will decide it. We will assign someone who knows nothing about either to argue to us why we should go to Holden. And we'll assign someone else, and we make sure they know nothing about this because, you know, that wouldn't work. And they'll argue the other side, and we'll listen to both. We'll have little rules about what they can and can't say. We'll call those rules of evidence, right? And we'll have them make their best case, totally self-interested case from that way. We'll stand in the middle, and we'll be able to mediate and judge how this works. That's sort of the idea of the adversary process. Whereas the inquisitorial process is everybody is sort of goes in it with an open mind. What can we find? Oh, well, here's some evidence. Here's some evidence. We'll do that. The other tension that I think goes on, and didn't put it up here, but I think it's particularly true in the O.J. case. And this is, I think, I don't want to say purely, but it's largely an American phenomenon. In most cultures, the most important questions that the culture has to decide are not decided in the context of legal cases. They're argued out in legislatures, in parliaments, in forums, in educational places. But America has a penchant for taking its most important questions and finding a case that we can attach them to. And now, that does two bad things. First of all, law cases are very bad vehicles for carrying on broad-ranging debates. Why? Because they come with these curious darn things called facts. And so, they want to restrict themselves to just the facts of the case, but we want them to do more. The other thing, of course, that it does is it takes this case that the lawyers are trying to try, and it tries to turn it into something bigger. So you take O.J.'s case, before the case got tried, if you had any doubt of whether the legal system would fail, you shouldn't have, because the legal system was being asked to decide the following things in the O.J. case. Could a black man get a fair trial in this country? Would another battered woman go without punishment? Can a celebrity get different rules than anyone else? Well, you know, and there's a whole lot more of these general lessons that we were supposed to learn from this case, but you can see right away from the first three, we got to get some of them wrong. Somebody's going to be unhappy, right? So I think that's at least peculiarly American. That there's a kind of a sense that all the important questions, we'll figure out a way to turn that into a case. And then we'll turn this case, which is supposed to be just about these facts, did A hit B? And we turn it into, what does this case mean for the A's of the world? How many B's will get away with this? Right? And that then sort of pollutes the case itself, and people stop talking about the individual facts of the case because they get in the way. We're trying to have a debate here, and these lawyers are worried about whether this glove was found outside the door or inside the door. Look at this, they're spending 3 days on where this glove was found. What does that have to do with whether battered women are going to get a fair shake? Well, it doesn't. It has to do with this particular case. Did this man kill this woman? And we need to know where the glove was because that helps us. But that's sort of, And the press, of course, is the mediator for us. And it tells us what we want to know, what we need to know. And they'll often say, oh, well, the lawyers have to do this at some kind of, some technical thing, so don't worry about it. And then they cut away for a commercial. And what's coming in, of course, is the critical evidence about whether somebody stabbed somebody else. Pre-arrest investigation, notwithstanding NYPD Blue and Hill Street Blues and all those wonderful cases, the way policing works in America is best summed up on Barney Miller. That's a much better metaphor in how it goes. In other words, between 85% and 90% of the police's learning about crime is they learn about it because people tell them. That is, it's a very largely a reactive process. Either police on patrol observe crime, or victims or eyewitnesses tell them about crime. From these other shows, you get the idea that police are mainly out there plotting and surveilling and infiltrating through plants. That goes on, but it's a very small portion. Most of it, at least at the local level, is highly reactive. Again, we estimate between 85% and 90%. Arrest is the step in the process, which of course physically brings the defendant into the process. The criminal process is really three processes. Three very, very different groups of people with different kinds of functions and motivations, and they all sort of blend into each other. We start with the police administrative process, which is a kind of an intake for the overall process, right? And those persons are trained in a very different way than people at in other parts of the process. At some point, that blends into a formal judicial process. This is the one that I guess we think about most readily when we think about the criminal justice system, lawyers in courtrooms and judges, etc. And then, of course, at the other end is the whole process called corrections, which for defendants who are convicted, I mean, that's the bulk of the time is spent in corrections. Although we don't think as much about the correctional problems. A lot of what happens in each of these little pods here cannot be fully understood without some idea of what's going on in the rest of the ponds. One of my favorites is people always say, why is it that when somebody gets sentenced to prison for 10 years, why is it we hear that they can get out in 5? How come we don't make them stay the whole time? And I mean, that sounds like a great question. The answer to it, you can only find if you get sort of deep into the way the correctional process has to work. Wardens have a difficult job. People who teach in junior high school have a difficult job. I admire people who teach in junior high school. I think there's a special place in heaven for those people. But it's nothing compared to what the wardens have to go through, because at least, with junior high school people, there's some sort of system of reward and incentive that you can put in place. Gets really hard when you have long-term prisoners to get any kind of a set of incentives that are going to make sense. You know, what do you threaten them with if they're in solitary confinement? You know, so one of the ways that the system says is, if we're going to help corrections work, if we're going to have a system of rewards and incentives, let's say, what is it that prisoners most want? Well, our original theory was they most want out. Okay, that's not always true, by the way. It's interesting. Some don't, but at least a fairly large percentage of them want out. And so, if we could promise them that if they were good, if they would behave properly and not cause a lot of trouble and not kill guards and that kind of thing, then we'll figure out a way for them to get out. And so, most American jurisdictions have what's called good time or mini max or parole. There's all kind of ways to talk about it, but the basic idea is, for every day that you spend without causing trouble here, we'll take a day off the other end, and we'll call it day for a day. And so when we get a 10-year sentence, at 5 years, if there's been nothing but good conduct, we've got enough. People say, well, yeah, okay, we understand that, but that still, we're not getting as much punishment as we wanted. We still said 10 and made 5, but here's the trick. The trick is we've doubled it to begin with. Right? If we really think 5 is what a person should serve, the legislature will write down 10, and then they'll provide day for a day. That's one way of understanding how the correctional system's needs sort of define what goes on back here. And if you have any doubt about whether or not we've doubled it, check some statistics for parallel crimes, for time actually served in the United States compared to almost any place else. It's right at the top of the list for length of sentence actually served for parallel crime. You can find some oddities in some countries. There are some Middle Eastern countries that have a real problem with certain drugs, and you do get that sort of anomaly. But for the most part, when you take homicide, robbery, burglary, anything, and take it worldwide, time actually spent in America, right at the top. And that's even before we talk about the death penalty. Move down a little bit here. The decision to charge, usually made by a prosecutor. I always tell my students, it really depends. If it's a minor crime, police are going to make the decision. But if it's a major crime, the real power to decide whether this case moves ahead or not is with the prosecutor's office. Students are going to become defense counsel. They need to know who's really deciding, because you don't want to spend a lot of time convincing the wrong person about it. Filing the complaint, a little terminology here. All lawsuits start with a piece of paper, right, that gets filed in court. In civil cases, we usually call it a complaint. In criminal cases, that piece of paper, which is filed by the prosecutor, is called various things in various states, but information is the most common one. That's one where the prosecutor's office simply files the complaint. If the prosecutor's office has to use a grand jury, that is, if this is a case that has to go through the grand jury, and that's going to vary a lot from state to state, Then the piece of paper is called an indictment. And of course, we use the word indictment generally, but in law, an indictment is a complaint charging the violation of a crime that comes from a grand jury. Grand jury is citizens. They're drawn from, just as the petit jury is for purposes of trial, the grand jury is drawn from the population using voting lists. Typically, they serve, depending on the jurisdiction, an 18-month or two-year period of time. Probably going in one day a month is fairly common. Federal grand juries terms now 2 years. So if you serve on a federal grand jury, it may be that on the fourth Thursday of every month, you'll go in for a day or a half a day, listen to all the cases that the government has, decide whether or not there's enough information that this person should go to trial. Okay, so it's not the trial. It's a kind of a process. It's a screening process. And here's what drove it. And this is deep in the English tradition. If I'm a prosecutor or if I'm a public official who can order prosecutors around, I can make your life miserable, whether you're guilty or not, by making you go through the system. Right? The process is the punishment, as some people like to say, right? So at the end, you're found not guilty. And so you walk away. Yeah, well, you walk away, but you spent a lot of money for violent crimes. You've spent all that time in detention, or most people have. And so the whole notion of the grand jury at the English level was, we're not even going to let the state put people through the process unless they can first convince some segment of the community that there's something to this, that it isn't just malice or ill will. So grand juries never have to decide guilty or not guilty. Basically, they have to decide, is there enough here that we think this is not just some vendetta that a public official has against us?
Isn't it true in the case of grand jury investigation, isn't it true? Prosecution pretty much holds all the cards. The rules are stacked way against the defendant in the case of a grand jury investigation, and the only benefit that they have is that the grand jury can't actually convict them of the crime.
That's correct, yeah, and you point out an interesting thing. Grand juries really have two very different functions historically. One of them, the one that I was talking here, is called the screening function or the protective function. That is to make sure cases don't go to trial unless there's some amount of evidence. Most states have done away with grand juries because, as you say, who's in the grand jury room? The prosecutor and the prosecutor's witnesses and the grand jurors. You know, it's an uncontested trial. Show me a lawyer who loses an uncontested trial, and you know, you got someone with a problem, right? In fact, because the whole idea of the grand jury is not was let's predict whether this is a winner or a loser. The whole idea was, let's make sure this is not malice. Let's make sure this is not just political oppression. So the standard of proof is very low, because they're only checking for that. You see numbers like 99%, 99.5% indictment rates of things that are referred from the prosecutor, and there's two ways of reading that. One is, the process is superfluous. The other way of reading that is, the process is working. That is, they know that the ill will prosecutions won't get past the grand jury, so they're not bringing. At least, you know, you can argue both of those things from the statistics, but you're right. No defendant ever says, well, I'm going to win this case at the grand jury. The reason that they're not very good is because they simply have too much to do.
Isn't that true, though, too, for the prosecutor's office, that they're getting paid about the same amount with the same kind of burden?
Yes.
So it kind of levels out.
Yes, although it's a little, their caseload's a little lighter, but we do put a lot on them. That's the other place, if you want quick litigation experiences, go to the prosecutor. Usually what happens there, though, is the people who just come in won't get to the felony cases
right. For
about a year and a half. They'll be doing traffic and minor misdemeanors.
It's common where I work. I'm a police officer. On the misdemeanor cases, the prosecutor won't even read the case until the morning of the trial.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you're walking, yeah. You're in the elevator saying, what happened?
Oh, that's right. Well, I mean, that's true if you're a low person on the totem pole in a law firm, just doing regular kind of cases, that may be there. If you represent, or if you're with a firm that does a lot of insurance defense, insurance companies are great defendants, obviously, and because they're getting sued all the time, right? And they're supplying the lawyer. I went into court many times where I had a secretary, I would drive and the secretary would read to me from the file on the way down, so I knew what kind of case we were trying. And here are these poor litigants, they've been on this case 4 or 5 years with different lawyers setting it up. You know, this didn't exactly inspire confidence in them that, you know, I'm being read the case on the way over there. I had a defendant back in New Jersey. We always think about public defenders and assigned counsel. When I came out of law school, I had a very idealistic look at this, and I said, boy, you know, the Supreme Court of the United States in Gideon versus Wainwright, isn't that a wonderful name for a groundbreaking Gideon, right? You hear the trumpets already. He said, this person who probably robbed this bank is entitled to have me there as his lawyer at state expense, and isn't this a great country we live in? And I got in there, and he took one look at me, and he said, how long have you been doing this? Well, boy, I better tell the truth, because this was a rough-looking character. They had a nice videotape of him with a gun in the bank. So it was not an easy case. But, and he said he knew who was prosecuting the case. We talked about it, and I said I was the assigned lawyer. And he says, yeah, America is a great country, isn't it? The government pays for the lawyer who's after me, and it pays for the lawyer who will sit next to me. And by the way, the one that they hired for the prosecutor is better. Boy, I'll tell you, I gotta take a quick seat on that one, and ow, boy, that hurts. You know, I came in here thinking I was doing this wonderful thing. They haven't figured out. They haven't figured out that it's all part of the system. And it's almost like we'll go through the motions. Here's a guy in a suit, he'll sit next to you. And now we have guys and gals with suits, they'll sit next to you. So, but it's just part of the whole apparatus. That's how many of them, see it. A trial, always like to say that criminal trials are exactly the same as civil trials, except entirely different. That is, the rules of evidence are roughly the same. The way the choreography works, the way the jury works is roughly the same. But we have some very interesting philosophical things going on in a criminal case that are not going on in a civil case. A trained lawyer could walk in to a courtroom with a jury there and a gallery and everything else the same. Can walk in, close his or her eyes, and tell whether it's a civil or criminal trial before they hear anybody speak. There's just something very powerful going on in a criminal trial. This is really a kind of a real morality play at a criminal trial. More is at stake in that sense, but also something more fundamental is going on. So what are the things in the criminal trial that are different? This presumption of innocence. Okay. That's an interesting thing. We might want to spend a day, maybe next week, talking a little bit about that. Something like 90%, maybe more, of the people who get to a particular stage in the criminal process are statistically guilty. Why then would you continue to presume innocence? Why wouldn't you presume what everybody else presumes? Which is the way my students start. If he weren't guilty, he wouldn't have been arrested. It's for the most part not true. I mean, there's a lot of slippage in there. But it's interesting because one of those statements, the statements about 90% turn out to be guilty, is an empirical statement. The presumption of innocence is a philosophical statement. They're not on the same plane. As a matter of fact, interestingly enough, if you find a culture where you have a presumption of guilt, 90% of the people who are convicted are innocent. think about how those two things work against each other. We can think of what some of those regimes were historically that worked that way. Another thing that's quite different is a defendant has an absolute right to stay off the stand. That's an interesting idea. It's a very that was a major question in O.J.'s case. Would he take the stand? Should he take the stand? Et cetera, et cetera. I have no idea why he didn't. Okay? Other than that, the lawyers must have thought at that point that they were in a very powerful position with the jury. And once you're in a powerful position with the jury, you don't sort of do anything to shake it up. But I mean, everybody I talked to ahead of time thought he had to take the stand. The reason most criminal defendants don't want to take the stand is because if they take the stand, then the prosecutor can engage in what's called impeachment, can start telling you all kind of reasons why you shouldn't believe this person, and those things are things like, he's been convicted of crime before, he's done this bad thing and that bad thing, and suddenly the jury gets all of these bad things that the defendant did, and they begin to think he's pretty much of a bad person, and they stop worrying too much about whether he did this thing. I mean, he's basically a sleaze, so let's get him for all these past things, right? That's the whole problem. If you stay off the stand, they can't do that. But you saw O.J.'s case, they had done that already. First thing out of the box in that trial was about 2 weeks of all of the attacks he had done in the past. I mean, anybody who taught evidence, we were calling each other and go, what's going on? How does the judge do this? Well, we're not sure. I mean, that's sort of out, not only outside American law, but outside California law, getting this much character evidence in. And all we could think is that the judge was sensitive to some idea that O.J. was such a positive persona, had such a positive image already, that this was sort of the way of giving the prosecutor something like an even playing ground at the beginning, to let us know that this image we had been told for 10, 20 years on TV was not the whole picture. No other way I know of to explain it. Let me stop, see what you want to ask questions about. We've got sentencing, appeals, post-conviction, relief.
I have a question about immunity.
Yeah.
There's a case right now, the guy is on trial in California, killed Bill Cosby's son.
Yeah.
There's supposedly the star witness that given immunity that the defense is claiming is the actual killer. Now, if he gets up there and says, I did it, this guy's innocent, what happens?
What happens is if they've given him what's called transactional immunity, which is my suspicion is that's what he has bargained for, they may not prosecute him for that offense. Which is to say, you don't give transactional immunity unless you're sure of what you're going to get from that witness.
What if he says something? What if he lies about it, knowing he's going to get immunity, and then later on says, well, I changed my mind. He didn't do it, but I did. They've given him immunity. Are they both off the hook?
Well, we don't know if the other defendant's off the hook. We know that we can't prosecute the person who's been immunized, but it may be that there's other witnesses, other evidence that get us at this other defendant. But if you're saying that A is the only way to get to B, and he promises, you know, if immunized, I will say this, and then he breaks that promise, for one thing, he's still subject to the perjury laws. So lying in court is he can still be prosecuted even though he's given immunity. But yeah, most prosecutors don't want to give transactional immunity because it promises too much. They're worried about just the scenario you're giving. So they give what's called use immunity, which means only that I can never use the testimony that I get from you against you. If I have independent evidence proving your guilt, I can still prosecute you, but what I can't do is use your own words against you. And that's all the prosecutors are required to give legal.
Because before we left, this guy was going to be going up to the stand, and they were saying that the defending lawyers have this star witness that's been given immunity that's going to pretty much say that he was the gunman, that he did the shooting.
Okay, I don't track on that, because if he's their witness, the defense can't give him immunity, only the prosecutor and the judge.
No, he was given immunity by the police department or somebody.
It has to be by a court.
Marcus said that he did it, but then turns out they're pretty sure he might have been the one who did it. Now.
The defense attorneys are pretty sure of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, according to the press, as we get.
Well, according to the guy that they're defending as well.
Well, I mean, it could happen, but it's a terrible mistake. If immunity is a formal request for a formal grant from a court. So it's not anything the police can just sort of give you. During interrogation, police make a lot of those sorts of promises that sound sort of like immunity, but they're not. You'll feel better if you tell us about this, that kind of thing.
On a different subject, I don't understand the grand jury process very well, and I'm really confused about the federal special prosecutor's powers. He's how many grand juries, it sounds like. Who controls?
As many as he needs, yeah. Well, that's what the statute says.
The prosecutor can call grand juries as he wants them, then?
He's
in charge of the whole system.
Well, let's talk about the regular prosecutor first. The regular prosecutor, who's called the United States Attorney, is in each judicial district. Some states are a district. Some states are big enough that they have Southern District, Northern District. But let's take where I'm from, Northern District of Indiana. The United States Attorney there, there's always two grand juries that are called regular grand juries. Okay? And they go for 2 years, and then they turn over and they get two more people. But occasionally he'll want to investigate a drug problem in some of the counties. So he has the power to call a special grand jury. And that grand jury will investigate just one kind of offense in one area. We had a big one many years ago where they had special grand juries involving corruption in the steel industry out there. And so people spent a couple of years putting those evidence together, calling witnesses, sending out subpoenas, getting a lot of information. Right? Now, the independent counsel is a special kind of prosecutor set up by Congress, not based on a particular geographic district, but based on a particular subject matter. Right? We want you to investigate everything that has to do with this. We could have an independent counsel to look into A, B, C, D, or E. Okay? This one's looking into corruption in the executive branch. Right? The statute, which forms the independent counsel, is extremely broad. I've read the statute, and you look at it and you go, where's the rest of it? Where's the part that says what he can't do? So it's extremely broad. On the other hand, when Congress is sick of it, they'll kill it. They'll just, when the money runs out, they'll kill it. But it's interesting. They were supposed to report up to the House in May. It now looks like Starr will report up in August. And just a guess here, that what Starr reports up is going to surprise you, because it's not going to be about sex, it's going to be about money. That's really what the investigation is about. I think the sex is a way to keep the press happy in the interim. That's another thing, that's a great big question. And I know you're feeling it on the other side. The process takes time. Americans aren't patient. The media isn't patient. Right? In Britain, we see a big case is filed, murder at Westminster. We'll tell you about it in about a year and a half when the trial happens. And then all the Brits go back to work and they stop worrying about it for a year and a half. And the press leaves it alone, because the press over there doesn't get involved in cases. The important issues are being decided somewhere other than in cases. And a year and a half later, they go, oh, that guy at the Westminster was guilty. How about that? Isn't that interesting? Around here, we obsess about it until it's done. We follow them around. What are they having for breakfast? What do you know today? I don't know anything today. Didn't know yesterday. Most days are like that, right? Yes, sir.
One of the things I thought was interesting about the
OJ. This is, I think, the last one. And,
yeah. Was that... I didn't follow the case closely, but I felt like the defense was able to successfully put the LAPD on trial. And that was apparently their strategy that they decided.
Accuse the accuser. So one of the oldest strategies in the world, right?
Yeah, and they seem to be able to do that very successfully. I mean, I felt by the end of the things that, right, based on what I've read, that the case had been horrendously botched by the police.
Right.
But I wonder if that's really the, you know, was that a unique situation in the Simpson case, or had, you know, one of the other unique facets of this case was that Bush had so much money that he could hire literally what they called the dream team, tremendously famous and successful attorneys. If anybody could hire that kind of dream team defense,
right,
could you tear apart any cases, you know, that the prosecution might bring?
I think that's right. Policing everywhere is not an exact science. Right? There's all kind of things that can go wrong. Some of them are actually corrupt. Some systems are actually corrupt. Some of them are just, not as competent as perhaps they could be. And so the more you focus on it, the more you find about it.
Sure.
The interesting thing to me is that the ordinary defendant can't penetrate that. Right? Doesn't have the time, or it's these kind of cases that are high visibility with a lot of money where we begin to see the tip of the iceberg of some of the things that might be wrong. I know there's a lot more people want to talk about. I'm going to stay here informally. You may shut the tape off. And I'm guilty now of false advertising because nobody asked anything about the au pair.
Well, I wanted to.
Come on up. We'll talk about her. But thank you all very much. See you tomorrow.